Nice place, I say, glancing around the room, noting the flat-screen TV, gaming consoles, and expensive sound system. Yours?
I'm looking after it for a friend.
What's your friend's name?
John Smith.
Felix lights up, swallowing smoke. He slumps onto a leather sofa, knees spread, convinced he knows exactly what happens next.
Lenny takes an armchair. Why was your old man so pissed at you?
Whites and coloureds.
What?
Felix grins.
I put a pair of red socks in a whitewash. Spoiled Mum's favourite blouse.
Lenny's gaze is absolutely neutral.
I've had smarter bowel movements than you.
I'm standing at the open glass doors, looking across the river at a nature reserve called The Hook, where acres of woodland are fringed by wildflower meadows and orchards. Do you know Councillor Verbitch? I ask.
Isn't he the mayor?
Used to be.
What about him?
Is he one of your customers?
Never met the guy.
Your father works for him as a driver, says Lenny.
Felix wrinkles his nose as though some unpleasant smell has reached him.
If we ask Councillor Verbitch, will he say he knows you?
This time Felix takes a moment, considering his options.
I might have met him. I meet a lot of people in my line of work.
What exactly do you do? I ask.
I told you, I buy and sell stuff.
Anything in particular?
Antiques, mainly.
I can't see any antiques around this place, says Lenny.
Not fond of them myself, says Felix, but a lot of folks like old shit. Your old man must tell you that all the time.
Lenny doesn't rise to the bait.
Business must be good.
I do okay.
The police found £6,000 in Jodie's school locker. Do you know how she got it?
No idea.
Can we look around?
Do you have a warrant?
With your permission.
Felix spreads his arms.
Knock yourselves out.
Clearly he's too experienced to keep anything incriminating in his apartment, but I still wouldn't mind seeing more of the place, learning things about him. I notice a BlackBerry phone on the glass coffee table. It's a brand favoured by criminal gangs because it can use military-grade encryption, making it almost impossible for police to access the data or intercept messages. Jodie was using a mobile phone the night she disappeared, I say, still looking at the BlackBerry. Not her usual one, but another handset, a cheap disposable most likely. It's only a matter of time before the police identify her new phone. They'll be able to read her text messages and look at her call logs.
Maybe even trace her movements,
says Lenny, picking up on the theme.
You think you're safe, Felix, because your data is encrypted. You can't hide the signal. Every phone has a unique signature that pings the nearest mobile phone towers, which means we can see where you've been. Every house, pub, car park, every girlfriend, every business meeting.
Felix has gone quiet. He draws on his cigarette and exhales, blinking into the smoke. His eyes drift lower, focusing on the BlackBerry.
He lunges, grabs the phone, pulls back his arm and hurls it towards the balcony door and the river beyond. In the same breath, I shove the sliding glass door. It closes on smooth runners and the phone clatters against the double glazing, landing at my feet.
I pick it up.
Give it back, says Felix.
It's a criminal offence to dispose of evidence, replies Lenny, taking the phone from me and sliding it into her pocket.
Felix is less certain than before.
You need a warrant.
We'll get one.
I watch how the young man changes. He wants to be menacing, but like a lot of weedy men, he's all push and self-possession, whereas someone like his father, a shambling, shaggy heavyweight, wears the crown more easily.
Was Jodie a runner? Asks Lenny.
No comment, he replies.
Did you know she was pregnant?
This time Felix hesitates and tosses us a bone.
She came to me a few weeks ago. Said she was up the duff.
Who was the father?
She didn't say.
Did you ask?
Another shrug.
What did Jodie tell you?
She didn't want Mum and Dad finding out. Mum would have thrown a wobbly, you know, crying and praying.
Jodie must have wanted something.
Cash.
Why?
The scrape, I guess.
Terminations are free. Why would she need money?
She wouldn't get it done in Nottingham. Too many people know her. She said she was going to London.
And you gave her £6,000. That's very generous of you.
She stole that from me. I keep a bit of cash around the place, you know, in case of an emergency.
Why didn't you get it back?
Felix doesn't answer.
She was blackmailing you, I say. Again, silence.
Felix puts his thumbnail between his teeth and bites at the edges.
Did you send her to a house on the rope walk on the night she disappeared?
No comment.
I'll take that as a yes. Who was she delivering to?
Felix laughs.
You must think I'm an idiot.
That's a given, says Lenny. The question is, how big an idiot?
I want to get back to Jodie.
When was she going to London? I ask. She didn't say. She brought an overnight bag around here and put it in the spare room. Said she'd come by and pick it up when she was leaving.
Where is the bag now?
Asks Lenny. Felix nods towards one of the bedrooms.
Can we take a look? I ask.
Felix's expression changes, his features pushing outwards in a calculating smile.
Do I get my phone back?
I see Lenny weighing her options.
If everything you've told us is true, I'll return your phone. But if you've been lying to me, Felix, I'll be all over you like a drunk aunt on a dance floor.
He smirks. In the bedroom, I open the wardrobe and pull out a small suitcase with a stenciled insignia for the British ice skating team. Lenny tosses me a pair of disposable gloves and dons her own. The main zipper slides open, revealing clothes. Knickers, tops, a sweater, two skirts and pair of jeans, as well as a woolen hat with earmuffs. There are separate pouches for Jodie's toiletries and makeup. Lower down, I find a soft toy, a floppy-eared rabbit with a missing eye and a chewed ear. She was taking folic acid tablets and reading a book called How to Grow a Baby and Push It Out.
Why pack a suitcase?
I ask, without realising I've said it out loud.
She was going to London, says Lenny.
Which is only 2 hours away by train. She didn't have to stay overnight.
According to Ness, Jodie was 11 weeks pregnant, which was still early enough for her to have a medical abortion. She could have taken a pill and come back a few days later for a second one. I look again at the contents of the bag, the clothes, the makeup, the vitamins, and the much-loved childhood toy. Suddenly, the answer is clear to me. Jodie wasn't terminating a pregnancy. She was running away.
Chapter 45. Tasmin Whittaker is still dressed in her school uniform when she answers the door. She opens it far enough to peer over the chain, squinting as though the sun is in her eyes. A dusting of icing sugar covers her top lip.
Mum and Dad aren't home.
It's you I wanted to see.
A shadow passes across her face.
I want to talk about Jodie.
Tasmin looks over her left shoulder, holding the door with both hands.
Who is it, Taz?
Asks a voice from inside.
The police,
she replies.
I'm not the police.
Aidan pushes Tasmin out of the way, opening the door wider. He's wearing track pants and a football jumper that hangs loosely on his slim frame. They don't look like brother or sister. It's as though Aidan was given first dibs at the beauty buffet, getting the eyelashes, cheekbones, and clear skin, while Tasmin had to make do with the leftovers.
What do you want? He asks. I was hoping I could talk to Tasmin.
I thought you did that already. I have a few more questions. Aiden seems to pounce on the statement. You can't talk to her without an adult present. It's not a formal interview, I reply, but you seem to know the rules. I'm reading law at Cambridge. I thought that was next year. Yeah, well, I know my shit, he says defiantly. Yes, you do, I say. You'll make a great lawyer. Aiden isn't sure if I'm teasing him. Tasman steps in between us.
I don't need a babysitter.
I could talk to both of you, I say. Aiden agrees grudgingly, and the door shuts behind me with a ragged click. We choose the sitting room because the kitchen table is covered in scraps of yellow fabric and a sewing machine.
Mum is decorating my coat for the memorial service, explains Tasman. Yellow was Jodie's favourite colour.
When is the memorial?
The day after tomorrow. Do you want a cup of tea?
She sounds like her mother. No, I'm fine. Aiden checks his phone before sitting next to his sister, who is perched on the edge of the sofa, as though I'm interviewing her for a job. She's holding a small stuffed monkey in her lap that makes her look younger. Is that one special? I ask.
Jodie won it for me at the Goose Fair. You had to get 5 balls through the hoop. I couldn't get one.
You two were friends for a long time.
We went to the same primary school and to Forsyth Academy and dance classes and skating. And we went on holidays together and other stuff.
Do you skate?
No. Daddy says I skate like a baby hippo.
There's no hint of regret in her voice. How often did Jodie come here? I ask, motioning around me.
All the time. We were like sisters.
Again, it's her mother talking. After school?
Yeah. Aiden used to help her with her homework.
I glance at Aiden for confirmation.
She was missing a lot of school,
he explains, not bothering to look up from his phone.
I helped her with her maths.
How often?
2 a week.
Who arranged that?
Aunt Maggie asked Mum, and she asked me.
Were you paid?
What?
Were you paid?
Yeah.
Another silence. Tasman is growing bored because it's not about her. She's playing with the monkey in her lap, twisting its arms into a knot and undoing them again. I talked to some of Jodie's skating friends who mentioned that she wanted to quit figure skating because of her injuries and headaches. Did she ever say anything to you?
Dad would have a fit, says Aiden.
I'm waiting for Tasman, who is looking at the scuffed toes of her school shoes, swinging them back and forth.
No,
she whispers, but I suspect she's lying. Did you ever feel jealous of Jodie? The question seems to surprise her, but she doesn't hesitate.
All the time.
Why?
It was always Jodie this and Jodie that. Every time she sneezed or sniffled or fell over, people would be fussing over her, calling the doctor, handing her tissues. Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she beautiful? Isn't she talented?
It wasn't like that, says Aiden.
How would you know?
Snaps Tasman.
They said the same things about you. You're the golden child and I'm the golden retriever.
Shut up, Taz.
You shut up!
I interrupt. Did Jodie have a secret boyfriend? Someone older?
What difference does that make?
Asks Aiden. I'm just trying to understand her. Tasman scratches at the bridge of her nose, but her eyes betray something other than jealousy or boredom.
Sometimes she'd tell Aunt Maggie that she was staying with me, but then she'd go off and do other stuff.
What other stuff?
You shouldn't be telling tales, says Aiden.
They're not tales. Jodie used to sneak out at night and come back before we all woke up. I used to worry that she'd be late for practice, but she never got caught.
Do you know where she went? I ask. Tasman shakes her head. When did this start?
During the summer holidays.
I turn to Aidan. Did you know?
I'm her cousin, not her babysitter.
You didn't notice her coming and going?
I'm not here,
he replies, pointing into the garden where a small egg-shaped caravan is parked against the back fence. A power cable snakes across the lawn to the house. How did Jodie get in and out? I ask.
I'd leave the sliding door unlocked on the patio,
replies Tasman. What about the night she disappeared? Did you leave it unlocked? She lowers her head and bites her bottom lip, leaving white marks in the indentations. Did you forget?
No.
A teardrop hangs on her lower lashes, growing fatter before it falls.
I wanted to punish her for leaving me alone at the fireworks, not taking me along.
You weren't to know,
says Aidan, putting his arm around her shoulders.
If I'd left the door unlocked, she wouldn't have tried to walk home. She wouldn't...
Tasman can't finish, and Aidan doesn't know how to comfort her. A door key slides into a lock, and the front door swings open. Brian and Felicity Whittaker carry bags of groceries into the hallway, still arguing about something that must have started in the car. They stop abruptly.
What are you doing here?
Asks Brian, his eyes sparking with anger.
I'm talking to Aidan and Tasman.
Without our permission?
Aidan is an adult.
The groceries are dumped without ceremony on the floor.
I don't want you talking to my children without us being here. I don't want you putting words in their mouths.
That's not what I'm doing.
Everybody is on their feet, and the sitting room feels small. Felicity has gone to Aidan, putting her arm around his waist. She went to him first, not Tasman, who is clearly more upset.
Jodie was pregnant and planning to run away, I explain. I thought she might have talked to Tasman.
You think our daughter deliberately withheld information?
Says Brian.
No.
That's what you're inferring.
It's all right, Brian, says Felicity. Let it go.
He accused me of molesting Jodie.
Tasman makes a gagging sound, and Aidan laughs sarcastically. I don't know what makes Brian Whittaker angrier, my presence or the reactions of his children. He's not a big man, but he makes himself larger, lunging at me. Felicity intercepts and pushes him back, warning me to leave. I take a business card from my jacket pocket and give it to Aidan and Tasman.
This is my address and my pager number. If you think of anything, get in touch.
You're not welcome here,
yells Brian.
Don't come back!
Felicity catches up with me before I reach the footpath. She pushes hair from her eyes, blinking wetly.
You have the wrong impression of this family, Dr. Haven. If you think we'd do anything to hurt Jodie.
Chapter 46. Angel Face.
The pizza is cold by the time it arrives. I have a slice and leave the rest to Keely, who eats noisily, letting cheese hang from her lips. In between mouthfuls, she guzzles glasses of pink wine from a box, treating it like cordial. Where does the food go? There's nothing of her. During the afternoon, an Uber driver had delivered two plastic bags containing clothes for me. A short suede skirt, red tights, knickers, socks, and a fitted white blouse with a Peter Pan collar. All of them new. The knickers are black and lacy, and a size too small. I have never worn a thong before. At Langford Hall, they issue the girls with grandma knickers from Marks and Spencer, and sports bras that never fit properly. Keely wrinkles her nose as she examines each new piece of clothing, holding it between her thumb and forefinger, as though she might catch something. The only thing she seems to covet is the patent leather ankle boots. She's sitting on the bed, waiting for me to finish showering. Where are you from? I ask, over the spitting water.
Why do you care?
I don't. There is a pause.
Sheffield.
Do you have family?
There's me and Mum and two half-brothers. They must be 2 and 4 by now.
You ever see them?
Nah.
Why not?
My stepdad.
The answer doesn't need elaboration. I've known at least a dozen girls from Langford Hall whose parents had split up and a new partner pushed them to leave. It's like when a new lion takes over the pride. He kills the cubs or forces them out, clearing the way for his own progeny. That's one of my daily words. Progeny. It means descendants or children. Blood is thicker than sentimentality. Turning off the shower, I reach for a towel and catch a hated glimpse of myself in the mirror. The bruises on my ribs are yellowing at the edges and turning a deep purple at the centre. They only hurt when I touch them. Emerging from the bathroom with a towel around my chest, I use another to dry my hair. Where does Felix live? Keely shrugs. Have you been there?
No.
But you're his girlfriend. Her eyes flare.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing.
You should keep your opinions to yourself and your hands off him.
I begin getting dressed. Keely spies my tuft of pubic hair and snorts with derision. What?
Your bush?
Embarrassed, I turn my back to her and slide the skirt over my thighs. Once I'm dressed, I risk looking in the mirror, surprised at the transformation. They used to bring me new clothes all the time when I was young, dresses and pinafores and leotards and gowns. Some made me look younger, others made me look older, but none of them felt like they belonged to me. A door opens somewhere, and voices echo through the derelict building.
They're here,
says Keely. Who?
You'll see.
The visitors are in the lounge. 2 black men in their 20s, and a skinny middle-aged woman wearing a sarong and sandals like she's holidaying somewhere warm. One of the black men, Chuba, has his hair shaved in rings around his head like crop circles in a wheat field. His friend is lighter-skinned but morbidly obese. He wants me to call him Rambo, but Chuba says,
Nice one, Kev. I can call myself Rambo,
complains Kev, who has multiple chins and rolls of fat that fill out a huge, shiny orange tracksuit that must be visible from outer space.
You should call yourself Star-Lord, says Chuba. Or the Hulk. Fuck off.
The middle-aged woman ignores their banter and lights a cigarette. She hasn't acknowledged me, concentrating instead on her phone and chewing at the edges of her fingernails like she's trying to sharpen them. I introduce myself. The woman ignores me.
Don't mind Carla, says Chuba. She's not a people person. She's a voodoo priestess,
says Kev, who starts singing, I put a spell on you, and waving his arms around like he's Harry Potter. Felix arrives, carrying 2 six-packs of beer. He's showered and changed, dressed up for a night out, in expensive jeans and a designer shirt. He greets Chuba and Kev with a choreographed handshake involving bumped shoulders and dabbed fists. Keely drapes herself over him, purring into his ear. Carla stops staring at her phone and says,
Sorry about your sister.
Her voice is coarsened by cigarettes, or alcohol, or both.
Yeah, bruh,
echoes Chuba.
Fucking intense. It was all over the TV,
says Kev.
Pictures of Jody and your folks.
Felix doesn't answer. What happened to your sister? I ask, more alert than before.
Nothing,
says Felix. Is she the girl who got killed?
Not up for discussion.
The statement is so savage that I bottle up my curiosity. Kev sits down and splays his legs, taking up the whole sofa. Chuba keeps moving in a loose-limbed sort of swagger, like he's playing a pimp on TV. Carla has lit up another cigarette, sucking so hard that the filter compresses between her lips.
What's she doing here?
She says, thrusting a bleeding fingernail at me.
She's a new recruit.
How do we know she's not a narc?
Does she look like a narc?
Replies Felix.
Where did you find her? At the bus station.
Oh, great. Yeah, she's definitely not a narc. Her sarcasm annoys Felix.
I found you at an AA meeting. Maybe you're the narc.
Carla backs off, but isn't happy. Felix tells me to wait outside. I don't mind. I didn't like the vibe in the room, or the direction of the conversation. Nobody had been lying, but I sensed how quickly the mood changed when Jody Sheehan's name was dropped. Cyrus didn't mention that Jody had a brother, and his name didn't come up in any of the police interviews with Craig Farley. Yet here he is, organising deliveries of vitamins or steroids, or whatever shit he deals in. It surprises me. I don't know why. It's not as if murder victims have to come from a squeaky clean family. Surely the opposite is sometimes true. Standing in the poorly lit hallway, I press my ear to the door, listening to the muffled voices, which become clearer when they relax and open the beers.
You gotta stop picking up strays, says Carla. It's too risky. She's a juvie, a runaway. Someone beat her up,
replies Felix.
She knows our names and what we look like. She won't be here long.
Good, says Keely. I don't like her.
All of you, shut up,
Felix says angrily.
I'll check her out before she does a run, okay?
Are we working tonight? Says Tuba. Or gas bagging?
No, I'm putting deliveries on hold for a while,
replies Felix.
I had a visit from the pigs today. They know fuck all, but we're going to lay low for a spell.
For how long?
Asks Kev.
Until the heat dies down.
I got bills to pay, complains Carla.
More like a habit to feed,
replies Kev. Carla must react because Kev says,
You're such a classy lady.
And you're a fat bastard, she replies.
Oh, I thought they caught the guy,
says Tuba.
Yeah, but they're still sniffing around. We'll give it a week, 10 days tops. And what are we supposed to do? Take a holiday? Go somewhere warm? You dress for it?
What about our customers?
Asks Tuba.
When we get back on track, we'll offer them a discount.
I step back from the door and wrap my arms around my chest, shivering, but not from the cold. I don't trust any of these people. I should have stolen the pizza money from Keely and caught a bus to London. I should have gone back to Cyrus. Even if he sent me to Langford Hall, it wouldn't be forever. What am I afraid of? I've spent most of my life in one box or another, waiting. The meeting is breaking up. Tuba and Kev leave together, filling the corridor with their laughter and bulk. Carla ignores me as she passes, disappearing in a cloud of cigarette smoke. Keely is wrapped around Felix, almost dry-humping his leg. He pushes her away and reaches into his pocket, removing a tiny plastic bag which he shakes against his thigh and gives to her.
Now piss off! I'm busy!
Keely looks at me with a mixture of disgust and loathing, but also a strange emptiness behind her eyes, like she's already left the building. I hover in the open doorway until Felix tells me to sit down. He gets another beer from a chest fridge, removing the top by hooking the cap on the edge of the counter and thumping the bottle with his fist.
You want one?
I shake my head. I thought I was delivering stuff.
Not tonight.
But my money.
Chill, you'll get it.
He turns on a stereo and cranks up the volume on an electro pop track with so much bass it shakes my insides.
What sort of music do you like?
He asks. Not this. He grins and sits on a stained sofa whose fabric has been worn thin by squirming asses. Beer at his fingertips, he takes a small glass pipe from his pocket, which has a bulb on one end like a pregnant test tube. It reminds me of the science lessons at Langford Hall where we distilled salt water into fresh water using a Bunsen burner and two flasks. Felix takes another clear plastic bag from his thigh pocket and holds it up in front of his eyes, examining the contents that look like tiny granules of rock salt. He pinches some of the crystals between his fingers and drops them into the glass pipe where they settle at the base of the bulb. Taking a cheap lighter from his pocket, he triggers the flame and holds it under the glass, filling the room with a soft crackling sound. Smoke, as white as cotton wool, appears in the pipe. Felix draws it deep into his lungs, puffing out his cheeks and letting his head loll back. The same smoke slowly leaks from his lips, lifting the corners of his mouth into an odd smile. It's like a chemical reaction, cause and effect, flooding his eyes with bliss. He hands the pipe to me. I shake my head.
Relax. Lighten up.
I'll have a beer. Felix collects one from the fridge, turning his back as he removes the top. I'm still staring at the glass pipe and the darkened crystals in the bulb. I have smoked weed before, but nothing like this. Maybe I should try it. What harm could it do? It's not as though my life has been a picnic up until now. The opposite is true. All questions and no answers. A real shit show. Counselors and therapists have always told me to accept my reality, but none of them has ever explained why. In a world full of suffering and sadness, why should anybody accept their reality when they could change it? That's why those makeover TV shows are so popular. They feed on people's compulsive desire to be someone else, to swap their boring, shitty life for something better, to avoid, to deny, to forget. Felix hands me the open beer. I wipe the top with my sleeve and take a drink, filling my mouth, cooling my throat. I don't stop until the last drop falls on my tongue. Another beer is pulled from the cooler. This time I hold it between my knees, telling myself to drink more slowly. Felix picks up the pipe and thumbs the flame. Smoke curls along the glass tube as he inhales. He holds the pipe towards me and turns the lighter upside down.
Don't be afraid. Relax. Let it happen.
I lean forward, opening my lips.
It's like riding a dragon,
he says.
It's like drinking in clouds.
My stomach spasms, and the walls of the room suddenly bulge and suck away. He gave me something. He spiked my drink. I know about such things, roofies and date rape drugs, but I didn't think. Should have thought. Stupid girl. Foolish girl. Felix is talking. His features seem to morph and transform into Halloween masks and monstrous creatures, all lips and teeth and multiple eyes.
What did you give me?
I slur, not recognizing my own voice. When did the music change? He pulls me up. I stumble. He catches me, putting his arm around my waist. I try to speak, telling him I want to lie down, but my words are garbled and make no sense. He's leading me along the hallway, holding me up as he fishes for the keys. The door opens to reveal a bedroom, a bed, a camera, a tripod. He lets me fall backwards onto the mattress, where I curl up, wanting to sleep, but a bright light blasts through my closed eyelids. He puts his hands on either side of my face and kisses me, his tongue pushing into my mouth, ammonia on his breath. I gag, turning my face away and grabbing his shoulders, trying to push him off, but he has wedged his knee between my thighs, forcing them open. Fingernails scratch at my skin, pulling elastic aside, rummaging like he's searching for a lost pound. I beg him to stop, but my voice won't make the sounds. In slow motion, Felix leans back and unbuckles his trousers. He grabs my head, pressing his thumbs into the soft flesh beneath my ears, guiding me towards him. I understand. I fight. I pull at his fingers, pleading for forgiveness or for mercy, although I don't know what mercy means. This is my life, who I am, what I've been. That person, used, abused, unloved, unlovable. My stomach spasms and guts erupt. Felix rears back, uttering a sharp cry.
Bitch!
He's holding his arms out, looking at the masticated mush of cheese and pizza dough clinging to his shirt.
This cost me £100!
He goes to the bathroom and takes off his shirt, scrubbing it under the running water. I know I have to run. I try to stand, but topple over. I crawl on my hands and knees until I reach the corridor and heave the remaining contents of my stomach onto the carpet. Getting to my feet, I stumble down the passageway, swaying from side to side, bouncing off the walls. I take in gulps of air, trying to focus. Somewhere behind me, the tap is turned off and light spills past me.
Hey, where are you going?
I've reached an unlit exit sign. I push down on the horizontal bar, shouldering the door open, and lurch across a landing to a short flight of stairs. Felix is close behind, reaching for me, clawing at my face to stop me screaming. He slams me against the brick wall, but his thumb has found my mouth. I bite down hard, feeling his skin break, reaching bone. He curses and releases his grip. I lash out with a boot, finding his shin.
Psycho bitch!
He yells. I'm free. Running. Revived by the cold air. Aware that my skirt is partially undone. I'm through the fence and onto the road, stumbling towards a light. A car swerves, braking hard, wheels locking. I spin away, turning the corner, not looking back. A bus, brightly lit, sounds a horn. I don't stop. I won't stop. Because he is somewhere behind me. Suddenly, my head fills with the blast of a police siren and a spotlight turns everything white. Momentarily blinded, I bounce off the side of a parked car and fall to the bitumen. A police officer is crouching next to me. He's saying something, but I can't make out the words. I'm a child again, fuddled by sleep and feverish dreams, conscious of a door opening, a figure backlit, whispering my name, pulling back the bedclothes, saying,
You know I love you. You know I won't hurt you.
A hand touches my arm, telling me to lie still. I would cry if I weren't so tired, so desperately tired.
Chapter 47. Her ribs are bruised, but nothing is broken, says a triage doctor, wearing crumpled blue scrubs and a cotton surgical cap cocked at a jaunty angle. A rust-coloured rosette of toilet paper is stuck to his neck that must have been there since this morning. He'll soon need to shave again. Evie said her drink was spiked, so I've organised a tox screen and given her drugs to counteract whatever she might have taken. I've also prescribed her some painkillers. Raising her arms above her head is going to hurt, so she might need help getting dressed. Was she... I don't finish the question. Sexually assaulted? I have no idea. She refuses to let anyone examine her internally. The waiting room of A&E is dotted with the broken, wounded, grazed and bleeding, all with jaundiced-looking faces from the fluorescent lights. I've been here since just after midnight, when the police messaged my pager. Evie gave them the number before she fell asleep in an ambulance on the way to the hospital. She's awake now, talking to the police officers that found her. I take a seat and watch a man with fuzzy hair and a food-stained shirt arguing with a triage nurse, demanding painkillers. She uses his first name and tells him to sit down or she'll call security. The man retreats to his shopping trolley, which is parked outside the automatic doors, laden with filthy blankets and folded cardboard. Two officers emerge from the consulting room and have a conversation, heads together, before summoning me. The more senior one looks at me with a sullen animosity, as if I'm personally to blame for his working nights and never seeing his family.
I'm PC Burton, he says. This is PC Huntley. How do you know Evie Cormack, sir?
I'm her guardian.
Do you have any ID?
I show him my driver's license.
What was she doing out last night?
What did she tell you?
She said she went out to meet friends and her drink was spiked. She says she can't remember what happened after that, where she's been or who she was with. She doesn't want to give us the names of her friends because most of them were underage. Can you help?
Not really.
When did you last see Evie?
Yesterday afternoon, I lie.
Do you have any idea where she was last night?
No. The officer is taking notes in a small flip-top notebook.
Listen, Cyrus, can I call you Cyrus?
He's going to do it anyway.
Evie was found with no money, or phone, or ID. The state of her clothing and her bruises indicate that she was attacked, robbed, and possibly sexually assaulted. It may be that she's too scared to reveal the identity of her attacker. You should talk to her. Tell her it's in her own best interests.
Is it, though? Of course, I say, trying to sound genuine, when I have no idea what to tell Evie. I have treated dozens of victims of sexual assault, some of whom reported their attacker to the police, and others who kept it secret. I can't say for sure which of them made the right choice. For every perpetrator who was punished, three walked away without being charged, or were cleared by a jury. Right now, all I can think about is Evie, what she's been through, how to make her whole. Finally, they let me see her. She's sitting on the edge of an examination table with her head down, letting a curtain of hair cover her eyes. She doesn't acknowledge my arrival or the sound of my voice. How are you feeling?
Like shit.
Are you in pain?
No.
The officers are watching how she reacts to me, reading her body language. No doubt my name will be run through the sex offenders register, and they'll contact social services, checking on my status as a foster carer.
I need the bathroom, Evie says,
pushing past me.
We still haven't made eye contact.
A nurse escorts her to the ladies and waits outside. The officers are talking on their phones. Occasionally, one or both of them glance at me. Can I take her home? I ask the doctor. Unless you want me to refer her to the psych ward. I'm a psychologist. It raises an eyebrow. Minutes pass. Evie has been gone too long. There could be another exit. She could be trying to run again. I have to stop myself grabbing a nurse and getting her to check inside the cubicle, but suddenly Evie appears. She has slicked down her hair with water and rubbed and washed her face. A nurse must have given her lipstick and eyeshadow. For the first time, I notice her clothes, the suede skirt, torn blouse and ankle boots, and wonder how and where she got them. Put this on, I say, giving her my coat. It's cold outside. PC Burton stops us before we reach the main doors. He gives Evie his card, telling her to call him if she remembers anything. She nods in a non-committal way. The younger officer escorts her outside, while his partner puts a hand on my shoulder, leaning close until his mouth brushes my ear.
If I discover you've touched her, I'm going to break your jaw and shit down your throat.
Chapter 48. Reaching for her seatbelt, Evie flinches and turns her face away, staring into the lightning sky. I start the engine and we pull out of the parking area, driving along near deserted roads wet from the rain.
Where did you go? I ask eventually.
I found a poker game.
For 2 days?
She doesn't answer. A bus pulls out ahead of us. I overtake, catching a glimpse of the brightly lit interior, where a handful of bleary-eyed shift workers rest their heads against the glass.
I won,
whispers Evie.
The police said you had no money.
I was robbed.
Who robbed you?
I didn't take down their names.
Normally a line like that would be delivered with sarcasm, but Evie doesn't seem to have the energy or the anger.
Why didn't you go to the police?
Why'd you think?
You could have sent me a message.
Evie looks at me with unexpected coldness, laying waste to something within me. Not for the first time, I recognise something missing inside her,
a deficit or arrears. I have never met such a pure nihilist. She is like a new species of human, raised in almost total annihilating self-hatred that has destroyed any self-regard she may once have had. In her mind and heart, she is an insult to the ground that she walks upon and the air that she breathes. All her strength, all her mental faculties are telling her that she must hate the world, that she must smash it to pieces before it destroys her. Yet all my experience tells me that she wants to be normal. She wants to be included. She's like a child who has never been invited to a party, but who presses her face against the glass, listening to the laughter and watching the games being played, hoping to be asked to join in, yet willing to burn the house down without a second thought.
"Are you sending me back?"
she asks, biting on the inside of her cheek. "I haven't decided."
"What? I'm on probation."
"You've always been on probation." My fingers grip the wheel too tightly, and I realise, not for the first time, that I'm afraid of Evie. I fear her physical proximity, and her darkness, and the damage she could inflict upon me when she senses her power. She gazes out of the window, no doubt aware that we're not heading home, or towards Langford Hall, but she doesn't say anything. I'm taking us east, across the river, past Trent Bridge Cricket Ground, and through the outskirts of Nottingham, where the houses give way to patchwork fields stitched together with hedgerows. The Radcliffe Animal Shelter has a small shop attached to a series of kennels, and prefabricated buildings that look like miniature aircraft hangars. "Come on," I say, getting out of the car. Evie is still wearing my overcoat. She follows me into the front office, where a woman behind a desk is chewing on a triangle of Marmite-covered toast. She licks her fingers.
"You're up early."
"We're looking for a dog," I say. Spinning her chair, she pulls out a form.
"Adopting or fostering?"
"Fostering," I reply. "For the moment." I pass the form straight to Evie. She blinks at me, lost for words.
"You put your name and address at the top."
There are questions on the page, wanting to know the size of our yard and whether we want an inside or an outside dog, what breed and gender. Evie keeps glancing at me, unsure of how to answer. "You choose," I say.
"You can meet a few,"
says the woman, picking up a walkie-talkie and summoning someone she calls Raptor. Moments later, a young man appears, dressed in a green uniform with heavy work boots. His hair is dyed blonde at the ends and pulled back into a ponytail. We follow him along a cement path to a series of low kennels and wire enclosures. The dogs have heard us coming and set off barking, spurring each other on.
"I got just the one for you," Raptor says. "She's my favourite. She loves being around people and doesn't cope with being on her own, you know, separation anxiety."
He tells us to wait in the yard. Evie watches him leave. Her hands are deep in her pockets. She seems to be holding her breath, anxious that I might change my mind.
"Is this a trick?" she whispers.
"No."
"Why are you being so nice to me?"
"That's the thing, Evie. You shouldn't be surprised when people treat you with respect. It's how it should be."
"Does this mean you want me to stay?"
"I've always wanted you to stay." She turns away, hiding her face.
"I went to the bus station, hoping I could get to London, but I didn't have any money. This guy came and talked to me. He offered me somewhere to stay."
Evie hesitates.
"It was Felix Sheehan, the brother of that girl."
"Are you sure?"
"Yeah."
I take a deep breath. "Did he... were you..."
"No."
"The doctor said you were drugged." She doesn't answer.
"Felix is a dealer. He doesn't deliver the stuff himself. He has people do it for him."
"Is that what he wanted you to do?" Evie nods. We have to tell the police. No. He attacked you. She looks at me pleadingly.
They'll send me back to Langford Hall.
Not necessarily.
I ran away. I gambled. I hung out with drug dealers.
Evie sucks in a breath and starts again.
I think he took pictures of me.
What sort of pictures? She shakes her head.
Please don't tell the police.
I want to argue, to change her mind. But at that moment, a door opens and a Labrador bounds into view, pulling on a lead and wagging her tail so furiously that her whole body is shaking. Raptor tries to hold her back, but she wants to sniff everything and everyone.
Her name is Poppy, says Raptor. We reckon she's about 18 months old. Still a puppy, really, but she's been neutered and microchipped and had all her jabs.
Evie has dropped to her knees and grabbed Poppy by the head, rubbing behind her ears and under her chin. Poppy's tongue lolls out, wanting to lick Evie's face. Evie laughs and wrestles with her, every movement practiced and assured. She's more comfortable around animals than people. That's why she wasn't frightened of Sid and Nancy in the kennels, why she stole food for them. Raptor is still talking.
She's very intelligent, although a little neurotic. We had to call the vet last week because Poppy chewed up some of her toys and swallowed the plastic.
He looks back at the kennel.
You want to see some of our other rescues?
No, says Evie. Poppy is perfect.
If she were mine, I'd walk her at least twice a day, maybe more. She needs lots of stimulation.
I will.
Evie looks up at me.
You want to pat her? She's really friendly. She has golden flecks in her eyes, see?
As I kneel down, Poppy tries to jump into my arms, knocking me backwards. I finish up on my backside on the damp grass.
She doesn't know her own strength, says Raptor. You should train her. Get her used to socialising with people and other dogs.
Evie nods, draping herself across Poppy. Paperwork has to be filled out, forms signed. I buy a bag of dried dog food from the shop, as well as a harness and lead, and bowls for the kibble and water.
Where is she going to sleep? Asks Evie.
I thought maybe the laundry.
That's too cold. Can she stay in my room?
We'll see how it goes tonight. Evie sits in the back seat with Poppy, cracking a window so the Labrador can sniff the air outside. I get behind the wheel and reach for my seatbelt. Suddenly, Evie wraps her arms around my neck and presses her cheek against my ear. It is a stiff hug, unpracticed, uncertain.
Thank you,
she whispers, her voice breaking.
Thank you.
Chapter 49 Angel Face.
I want to tell Cyrus what happened. I want to tell him nothing. Confiding in him would go against everything I was ever taught. Trust nobody. Believe in nothing. Terry told me that. He proved it.
You think you can rely on someone?
He said.
You think you know their name? You think you've seen their worst side? But that is a blindness. You haven't looked closely enough.
Sitting at the kitchen table, I shuffle the cards and deal a hand, playing them in my head before shuffling again. Cyrus is at the sink using a sharp knife to divide slabs of chuck steak into portions that he'll freeze for Poppy. The Labrador is sitting on her haunches, hoping a morsel might fall to the floor.
Don't you dare feed her from the table,
says Cyrus. I let my hand slip from my pocket and drop a piece of meat under the chair. Poppy sniffs it out and guzzles it greedily.
Labs are notorious overeaters, says Cyrus. You don't want her getting fat.
Poppy is licking my fingers. Cyrus is talking about building a run for Poppy in the back garden.
She can't stay inside all day. She's too destructive.
I glance towards the laundry, where one of his night runners has been chewed into a scattering of rubber, mesh, and synthetic leather. I'm sorry about your shoe, I say, for the umpteenth time.
I'll pay for new ones.
What with?
When I get a job. Cyrus doesn't comment. The Labrador seems to be listening. Her paws make clicking sounds on the floor as she crosses the kitchen, wagging her tail and shoving her nose into Cyrus's crotch. He pushes her away.
We should teach her not to do that.
She's saying sorry.
She's begging.
I laugh and produce a phone from the pocket of my smock dress. It was on my pillow this afternoon, along with a note saying, I know it's second hand, but I can't afford a new one. As I tap the phone, the screen lights up, showing the different icons and apps. I don't have anyone to call, but that's okay.
I've programmed my pager number into the contacts, says Cyrus. Next time, if you get into trouble...
I won't get into trouble.
I know, but just in case.
A piece of meat drops from the chopping board and is quickly gobbled up by Poppy.
Hey, you said not to feed her.
That was an accident,
says Cyrus, winking at me.
You have a bathtub,
I say, in a mildly inquiring tone.
Yes.
I've never had a bath. At least, I don't think I have. I don't remember.
You can borrow mine,
he says.
When?
Whenever you like.
Now?
Sure.
I go upstairs and collect a towel. In Cyrus's bathroom, I adjust the taps and begin filling a deep, claw-footed tub. Spying a bottle that says bath crystals, I pour half the contents into the running water. Pillows of foam erupt from beneath the taps, getting higher and higher. Maybe that was too much. Slipping out of my clothes, I avoid looking in the mirror, because my bruises look like the inkblot tests that Guthrie used to give me.
What does this remind you of, Evie?
He'd ask. A vagina.
And this?
Another vagina. It did his head in. Having run the bath, I slide into the tub, sending a tsunami of foam spilling over the sides onto the floor. I'm not sure what to do next. In a shower, you wash yourself. But in a bath, going by the films I've seen, people read magazines or drink champagne or go to sleep. I rest my head on a folded hand towel and close my eyes, letting the warm water soak into my muscles and bruises. I can see the point of baths now. I'm going to stay in this tub forever. Cyrus knocks. Immediately, I cover up, before remembering the door is locked.
Are you okay?
He asks.
Yeah.
I thought you might have drowned.
No.
Okay.
Hey, Cyrus.
Yeah?
How do you get scurvy?
By not eating enough fruit.
Oh.
Why?
My fingers have gone all white and wrinkly.
I wait.
Why are you laughing?
No reason.
Chapter 50. I hear the news on the radio the next morning. The alleged killer of schoolgirl Jodie Sheehan is under police guard in hospital after a failed suicide attempt. 26-year-old Craig Farley was found hanging from a torn bedsheet in his cell at Her Majesty's Prison, Nottingham, and was revived by a prison medical team. Farley was charged 2 weeks ago with the rape and murder of Nottingham schoolgirl Jodie Sheehan, whose body was discovered near a popular footpath. My pager is vibrating, showing Lenny's number. Opening my laptop, I Skype her. Her face appears on screen.
You heard the news?
Just now.
It's another sign of his guilt.
If you say so.
Lenny doesn't take the opportunity to gloat.
Farley's lawyer has given you permission to talk to him.
Why now?
The guy is suicidal. You're a psychologist.
She makes it sound like a simple sum.
The hospital has a psych department.
Yeah, but he asked for you.
A police officer is dozing on a chair in the corridor, his hat resting over his eyes. Nobody has told him I'm coming. He grumbles and mutters darkly under his breath before making the necessary calls to confirm my visit. Half an hour is wasted. Farley is out of intensive care and in a private room. I knock. Enter. He's lying on a bed, facing the window where the blinds have been left open, and the sky outside is the colour of cigarette ash in a white bowl. "Hello, Craig," I say. He turns his head, and I notice the bruising around his neck. He looks at me with interest, frowning, as though he's expecting someone older, or someone else, or salvation in general. The future is a scary place when you've been charged with raping and murdering a child. Prison is not an end point. Paedophiles and child killers are the lowest form of life behind bars, normally segregated or held in solitary for their own protection. Farley might not be the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree, but he knows what awaits him. The beatings, insults, and hurled bodily waste, until the inevitable moment when a crude shank finds its mark, and if he's lucky, he's condemned to pissing into a bag for the rest of his days. He has lost weight since I last saw him in the interview room at West Bridgeford Police Station. His face has thinned out, and his eyes seem to be submerged in pools of shadow. "My name is Cyrus," I say. "Do you mind if I sit down?" He doesn't answer, but I take a chair and pull it closer to the bed, settling. "How are you feeling?" No response. "Do you mind if I turn the light on?" I don't wait for him to answer. I can see the blue of his eyes and the dry patches of skin on his forehead. "You can always try again," I say.
"What?"
"If you really want to die, you can always try again." He frowns, unsure if I'm being serious. "How old are you, Craig?" "Mid-twenties. Steady, young man. You could live to be 90. You could choose any one of those days to die. What's the rush?" I wait for an answer. Each second without sound creates tension, like a rubber band being stretched out.
"Aren't you supposed to talk me out of dying?"
he croaks, his vocal cords bruised by his near hanging. "Everybody dies, Craig."
"Yeah, but that's different."
"You mean they wait for old age, or disease, or some tragic unexpected accident?"
"Yeah."
I lean forward and rest my elbows on my knees. "You're not special, Craig. Most people contemplate suicide at some point, even if it's only to imagine who might show up at the funeral and what they might say. Living isn't evolutionary. We can pull a trigger at any time, step off a cliff or walk in front of a train or wrap a torn sheet around our necks. Most of us don't. We wait and see what happens." Farley pretends not to be listening. He reaches for a cup with a straw and takes a sip, staring at me over the rim. "I don't think you killed Jody Sheehan," I say. He blinks at me. "Maybe you played a part. Maybe you could have saved her, but I don't think you killed her." The silence in the room magnifies the humming of the air conditioning. "I can understand why you were charged, and why you'll be convicted. You pulled down her jeans and her underwear. You masturbated into her hair. That's pretty damning stuff. Most people would happily put you away for a long stretch. Some would pull the trap door. But while I have you, I want to ask a question. Why? Jody was right there in front of you. She was everything you desired. Young, pretty, unconscious. You could have done anything to her, but you didn't."
"You're sick."
"Did you lose your erection when you tried to penetrate her? Maybe you wanted to humiliate her." Farley's fist rattles on the side of the bed where he's been handcuffed to the frame. "I know you put branches on her body, but it's not as though you covered your tracks. You left footprints at the scene. You tied your dog to a nearby tree. You bragged to a schoolgirl that the police had found Jody. You couldn't have made it any more obvious if you'd hung a sign around your neck saying, 'Arrest me.'"
"I'm not dumb."
Prove it to me.
Farley goes quiet. I let the silence build until it fills every corner of the room. It leaks into his ears and his chest and his bladder and his bowels and every dark place in his mind. Very few people are comfortable with silence. It's one thing to be on a plane or in a train carriage or in a waiting room and to ignore those around you, but not when you know someone is expecting you to answer.
How?
He mutters.
Tell me what happened. The whole story. I'm not the police. There are no cameras or recorders, no notebook, no witnesses. I'm not a priest. I can't take your confession. I don't care if you're guilty. I don't care if you feel guilty. I only want the truth.
Farley turns to face the window, and I wonder if he's chosen to stonewall me.
I didn't chicken out,
he whispers.
What were you doing on the footpath?
When I can't sleep, I walk my dog.
Why did you choose that path?
It's close to home.
There are parks that are nearer.
Farley raises his shoulders, drops them. It might be a shrug. It might be resignation.
I got a dog yesterday, I say. A Labrador called Poppy. She's not really mine. She belongs to a friend of mine who's staying with me. But we're going to take turns to walk her. I do the night walks because I don't like my friend going out alone.
Farley is listening.
Our nearest park gets locked up at dusk, so last night I took Poppy around the block a few times. It's a different world at that hour. You think the roads would be deserted, but all sorts of people are out walking their dogs. Some stop and chat, talking about the weather or the stars. Last night I was two streets from home and I looked up and saw a woman getting ready for bed. She'd left her curtains open.
Was she naked?
Asks Farley, facing me again, more animated now.
She was wearing a dressing gown and drying her hair.
How much could you see?
She was studying herself in the mirror, turning her face left and right, as though she was searching for something she'd lost.
What?
Youth. Farley doesn't understand. I felt sorry for her. She looked lonely. I wondered if that's why she'd left the curtains open, to be noticed.
Lots of them do,
he says.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Is that why you go walking at night?
He goes quiet.
Is that what you were doing on the night you saw Jodie? Looking in windows?
Again, nothing.
Did you see Jodie on the footpath?
No.
Where was she?
In the water.
You first saw her in the water?
I heard her.
What did you hear?
He looks at me plaintively.
Splashing.
I make him go over it again, describing how he left home with his dog and went along certain roads where he'd been lucky in the past. At some point, he decided to take Silverdale Walk, past the school and across the tram lines. As he approached the footbridge, he heard someone cry out, and then a splash.
I thought it was an animal, you know.
What did you do?
When I got to the footbridge, I peered over the side. That's when I saw her.
Jodie.
He nods.
I didn't know it was her. I thought somebody had dumped some rubbish into the pond. I went to check it out, in case it was something valuable, you know. But I saw her moving. She was crawling through the reeds.
He swivels his head slowly, eyes wide, wanting me to believe him. I can smell the sweat rising from his body and the faint hint of urine.
Then what?
I scrambled down the bank. I thought she might need some help. She was coughing, wet, cold. I wanted to keep her warm.
I offered her my jacket.
What did she say?
Nothing.
He lifts his eyes, blinking miserably, unable to make his mouth form the words.
She ran away. You chased her.
I didn't mean to hurt her. I wanted to make her warm.
But you didn't. You tied your dog to a tree. You undressed her. You were going to rape her.
His head rocks from side to side.
You tried to have sex with a dead or dying girl.
Please don't say that.
That's why you couldn't penetrate her.
No. No.
The handcuffs rattle against the frame.
You could have called an ambulance. You could have kept her alive. You could have saved her. Snot is running.